Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in.
All right, Austin, thank you for joining us today.
Unfortunately, I don't have a choice. I'm always here.
You've done a few podcasts already, but the point of this is really for our listeners to get an understanding of yourself. So why don't you start by giving them maybe a 30-second, super high-level background on yourself.
Cool. Count it down. As Mayu said, I am a real estate investor. I live out in Toronto, invest primarily out in Windsor, 25 years old, primarily focus on the BRRRR strategy and have been raising capital to purchase a lot of my most recent acquisitions. Still working a full-time job in finance at the big five banks, but the ultimate objective with this entire real estate portfolio is to retire early and live life on my own terms. Did I do a good job? Was that a bit too high level?
That was super high level.
Yeah.
All right. So you work in the big five banks right now. So I guess how many properties are you at today? And let's start with like, what are your goals really?
Yeah, I think I'm at about 19 or 20 properties around that range.
Too many to remember, eh?
I know. Sometimes it's hard to keep count. So the goal in terms of real estate specific is not really a property count. It's more of a cash flow type of goal, because for me, real estate is a means to an end in terms of being able to reach early retirement and be able to chase my dreams and do things that I enjoy in life. So the amount of properties has never been anything significant to me. I could own 3 properties, and if I could cash flow $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a month, that would be great. The ultimate goal for me that would make me say, hey, I'm ready to leave my full-time job, is probably around the $7,000 to $8,000 range. I can't say that I'm going to reach that within the next couple of months, but I do definitely think it's a reasonable goal by next year. And after I do hit that financial independence number, it's not goodbye to real estate forever. I do enjoy real estate. I enjoyed the thrill of deal hunting, but more so I'm going to focus on the aspects of real estate I like. And with the aspects of real estate I don't like, I'm either going to outsource that or maybe just not even do that part at all. Find someone who can assist me on that other half.
Yeah. So I guess, was that always your goal when you got started, or has that kind of evolved into what it is today?
Financial freedom has always been the goal. For a lot of us getting into real estate, the appeal of it is that we get passive income, or what is known as passive income, because it's not truly passive. And as we build those income streams, again, it's going to be supplement our full-time income, then eventually replace it. So the goal has never really changed. I do think the number has changed, because what I did realize is that when we start investing in real estate, our numbers, sure, they're conservative, but we don't project for all of these other things that will eventually come up in the world of real estate, like maintenance. If something happens to the roof, that's 5 to 7K coming out of your account in one swoop. And that's a lot of cash flow, especially if you're only cash flowing $200-$300 a month. That takes a long time to recoup that amount. And so I have been much more conservative in my numbers when estimating my cash flow number to retire. So I know most people might budget 10% for CapEx and repairs and vacancy, which is what we do. But when I get closer to the retirement number, I might start budgeting 15 to 20% because I'm not going to have any other source of stable income to keep me afloat. And when shit hits the fan in real estate, I need to make sure that I'm, one, making enough income, but two, I have enough savings to supplement anything that, not supplement, to cover any expenses that might come up. So as I get closer and closer to that retirement number, I find that I'm pushing it higher and higher. If you were to ask me, would I retire at the number I'm at today? I would have said yes. But now I'm here today and I have that number. There's no way in hell I feel comfortable retiring at this number. Because I do realize, as the deeper I go in my journey, I realize there's more things that come up. And you just got to be safe, right? Once you make that jump, that's your parachute.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you're sensitizing your cash flow, right? Like you're putting a sensitivity range on it, and you want to have sufficient buffers and cash reserves. So that makes a lot of sense. You're 25 or 26 now?
25.
Yeah, 25, 20 properties. When did you buy your first one?
I bought my first one in September 2018. I actually began my real estate journey in August 2018. By began my real estate journey, what I mean by that is that real estate investing had never run across my mind. However, I thought of becoming a real estate agent part-time. Why? Because everyone was a real estate agent part-time. And I thought it was easy money, which we both know that is so far from the truth. And as I was exploring that lane, a buddy of mine recommended me to read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So keep in mind, all throughout this process, investing had never struck my mind. Picked up the book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And we both know, we both read that book, how impactful that is to shifting the mindset. Understanding the difference between assets and liabilities. Assets being things that put money in your pocket every single month. And Mayu, you're an accountant. I know you're going to freak out because that's not the actual definition of an asset. But that's a wealthy person's definition of an asset.
Yeah. Things that put that's money, a real definition.
That's a rich man's definition. It's things that put money in your pocket every single month. And liabilities are anything that takes money out of your pocket every single month. So one thing that Robert Kiyosaki said that was quite controversial, who is the author of the book, is that your primary residence, not an asset, it's a liability. And I agree with him because that's money coming out of your pocket every single month. The only way you're going to net money out of that is through appreciation, right? The equity pay down, you're not really making money because that's essentially like putting it in a savings account. It's just money that you're sinking in there. And once that concept stuck in my head, I thought to myself that I definitely need to invest in assets that produce me income, and I can take that income and reinvest it into the assets again. And then I'll get even more income and do that again and again until my asset base produces so much income that my income doesn't need to come from my full-time job anymore. It can come purely from my asset base.
Yeah. So that was August of 2018. So up until that point, you weren't aware of, let's call it, the Canadian real estate ecosystem?
Nothing. It all started with wanting to become an agent.
So August 2018, you read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and then what do you do?
Yeah, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and I knew that I wanted to invest in real estate. I didn't know how. I didn't know when I'd buy my first property, but I knew real estate was definitely the path to go down. And as millennials, the first thing we do is we YouTube things. And I YouTubed Real Estate Investing Canada. And I ran across a lot of the big YouTube personalities we know and love today. Matt McKeever, Matt Pichet, Mike Rosehart, all of those other Canadian YouTubers in that ecosystem. And that's when I really started to do a bit of research. But I'll be frank, after watching a couple of videos, especially Matt's Burr video, I thought that real estate investing wasn't going to be that hard. So immediately after that, I started searching for my first property. Toronto was out of the question because we know the price points in Toronto are ridiculous. A parking space is $100,000. I didn't even have that amount of money. I was starting off with 40 grand. Okay. And the only market I could afford at the time would be Windsor. And knowing that, I just decided to jump in and I just hit the ground running. I just started searching for deals at Windsor and ended up picking my first property up there in September 2018. And it closed around October, I want to say. But all of that was within a month and a half time period. I just hit the ground running, which is good. It's action taking, but at the same time, it's scary. And I think as a first-time investor, it would make more sense to be a bit more patient because I wasn't well-versed in the educational portion of things. I just was overly eager to get started.
Like you said, it comes with good and bad, but ultimately, you would have been 23 or 24 at that time.
Yeah.
Real estate is, as we both know, one of the most forgiving assets. So really almost any mistake that you can make over time would have gotten adjusted and fixed, right? So let's dig a little bit more into that. So you started off with 40K. How does a 23 or 24-year-old accumulate 40K?
It's not easy to accumulate that amount. I was fortunate and not fortunate in a sense. Not fortunate in the sense that my parents come from regular blue-collar living. However, fortunate that I picked up on the concept of frugality through them because they would coupon shop. They would price match all the time. And those are habits that I picked up, seeing them save a lot of money. And when I was a kid, whenever I got Chinese New Year money, whenever I got Christmas money, birthday money, that would all be saved in an account, in a bank account. My parents made me a bank account when I was young and I never had access to any of the cards. And that's a lot of money, right? Until you're up 17, 18 years old. And that's when I got my full-time job. that's when I started working internships. Sorry, prior to that, I was working in high school as well, every single summer job, saving money. And then going into university, I got a scholarship. So a lot of tuition was covered from that scholarship. Then I had internships. I had about 16 months of internship. So you can make quite a decent amount of money during that time period. With all of that, I was able to save quite a bit of money. Again, that was being frugal in nature, because I know a lot of university students as well who would be making the same amount as me, but they would be spending it all. And I didn't do that. I did spend, but I was very cautious of how much money that was coming out of my bank account. And by the time I graduated university, I ended up having 40K. So it was not a secret. It was just saving and collecting over time. For a lot of people who don't have 40K, there's nothing else I can tell you. You got to grind it out. You got to work your full-time job, your part-time jobs. You got to have a side hustle. You got to just boost up your revenue stream and save. That's the hard part, not boosting up your revenue streams. The hard part is saving, because a lot of people, when they see money come in, they want to spend it on something. They want to treat themselves out. And that was me. I got an internship and then I was like, well, I'm going to get a Burberry t-shirt. And that's not a financially responsible decision, but it was small treats like that. But those small treats add up to a lot of money, because you find you treat yourself much more than you deserve.
Yeah. No, I'm exactly, well, I'm the polar opposite, which is why I can understand exactly what you're talking about. Like, I had those co-ops and internships during my undergrad as well. And what came in went out. Like, it was just like 4 month co-op. Okay, that'll last me the next 4 months. And then I'm back at work. Okay, thank God, another paycheck. And so it was a recycle. So I burned through like so much money in my undergrad days that like, if I'd followed the same trajectory as you, like I think it would have been crazy. So, okay. So you had 40K at this point, which isn't a whole lot in the real estate world.
Not a lot.
So maybe that gets you to the 20% down payment and closing costs in Windsor. Your parents were obviously aware of what you were doing. What did everyone think about you investing in Windsor?
So my girlfriend didn't think much of it. She was always supportive of what I've done, regardless of her thoughts, because you can always kind of tell by the facial expression through conversations, but verbally she would always support me, which was all that mattered at the end of the day. My parents were pretty supportive as well, although they were afraid at the same time. We're so used to seeing turnkey properties and being attracted to it, including myself, but the turnkey properties were out of my price range as well in Windsor, so I needed something that was a fixer-upper for sure. My dad actually went down with me to Windsor the first time, and we're taking a look at different properties. And the ones that attracted him the most were the turnkey properties. Mm. And when I told him this is the one I wanted to choose, he was very hesitant. And I understood, because I was very hesitant as well into jumping into it. But it is what it is. And at the beginning, they definitely had a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, a lot of, I don't know if you should be doing this, but as time went on, as my portfolio grew, and it's funny, as I started building an online presence and having videos pop up on YouTube, I would sometimes in the middle of the night, I'd hear my own voice in the house. I'm like, oh, my dad's watching my video, right? But it even gives a sense of credibility. Being online helped them get over those fears as well, because for whatever reason, when I'm online, it's different than when I'm talking in person with them. So they see what I say online and they're like, oh, he knows what he's doing. So they've turned around a lot more. They've been very, very, very supportive of my journey. But at the beginning, of course, as we expect, a lot of people had they had their doubts, including myself.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of people deal with the same issues when they're just starting out. So was a plan always to grow a big portfolio, or did you just think, you know, like, let me get this one, maybe like 2-3 properties and just call it a day?
No, so the plan was to get financial independence. I didn't know what the portfolio size would be to achieve that. Yeah, I thought I would buy maybe 2 properties in my first year, 2 properties in my second year. So I was actually running math by thinking the pace I could grow my portfolio. And on average, I thought I could acquire 2 properties a year, which we know that's not the case, because it's been less than 2 years and I'm up to 19, 20 ish. So
how did you get to that stage of 19 to 20? So you had 40K saved up, you bought that first property. Why don't you walk us through the numbers super high level and then give us an understanding of how you get to 18 or 20 properties now?
I didn't envision that. I want to put that out there. I didn't know it would scale to that extent. But if you are hungry and that's in your mind, then I definitely do think it's possible. How I got to that. So first property had 40 grand saved up. purchased the property for $130K. I don't have my calculator. I'm not even going to bother to attempt to do the mental math. You can try to keep track of it if you have your calculator. Yeah. But I purchased my property for $130K, had to put 20% down, and then I had closing costs. Let's say closing costs are about two grand or so, maybe three
let's,
grand.
Let's call it four. So we're at 30 grand total right now.
Okay, yeah. So about 30 grand total. And then renovations cost me, it was probably around 17, 18K. And then I had holding cost of another maybe 4K or so, whatever that number is. All in, I was close to probably about 53 to 55K.
Yeah, okay. I'm at about 50 right now. So you had 40K. So how do you fund that missing? Was it just like you borrowed money essentially or?
Yeah, so I didn't have any lines of credit set up at that time, which definitely if I could go back in time, I would have set all of my lines and credits and have that in order. But again, I was going through it my first time. I didn't know what the process was. So as things started slowly going above budget, because I budgeted 10 grand for renovations, we're damn near at 18K for renovations. So that's pretty much double what I anticipated. I was freaking out, definitely. And I didn't have the cash reserves for that. What I did was I had to ask my girlfriend and ask my parents for money and borrow it from them. I think at this point, I was too deep in it. So I didn't have any other option at that point. I'll be frank with you. If I was going into the investment prior knowing I didn't have the funds for it, I probably wouldn't have asked them. And I wasn't intelligent enough to know to know what lines of credits are. But now in retrospect, I would probably either get lines of credits to fund it or I would have asked them in advance. But knowing where I was and starting off, I didn't feel comfortable asking them. And that's with a lot of first-time investors. You don't feel comfortable asking your loved ones for money because you don't know if you're going to give it back to them or not right off the bat, right? But you got to have to get over that fear and gain more confidence in the asset class, gain more confidence in your skill set. Maybe with the 40K you have, maybe spend 10K of that coaching, right? Getting more familiar with real estate and all of that. Then borrow, then put that 30K into working into an investment and borrow the rest from your parents. Because at this point, you have a coach that you paid who's helping you guide you along the way, right? But at that point, my back was against the wall. I didn't have enough money. I asked my parents for funds. So all in, how much am I in for? Maybe let's say...
Let's just call it 50.
Okay, let's say I'm in for 50K. The property reappraised for 178K about 4 months later. Luckily, a good chunk of that was appreciation. I'll be frank, because the Windsor market was on fire. So how much are we left in?
78 times 0.8 gets you. So you got back about 142. You're going to settle your original mortgage on the purchase price of 130, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so you're going to settle 104, so 140. So you're pulling out about 40 grand.
Yeah. So about 40 grand. Yeah. So I was in, maybe some of the numbers I gave were a bit mixed up, but I was in about 15K when all was said and done after the property. Luckily for me, I got my entire rent payment up front for my first property. And of course I took that. So that was
That's like another like 20, 25K.
Yeah, it was well over 20K. And then I had my refinance money. So even had more money than when I started with. And then I decided to partner with a buddy of mine and go 50-50 on a second property. That one, I'm going to spare you the numbers, but it turned it out being 3K tied in. So we had most of our money tied out. Then I bought a duplex right after that. Right. So
because you're pulling out your money almost nearly on every single deal. And arguably if you're frugal, then that 8K or 5K that you leave in kind of nets out against your frugality and you kind of replace that money and you keep growing.
Exactly. Yeah. However, this was a relatively slow pace because we know from purchase to renos to refi, it takes quite some time.
What's your average timeline?
It really depends. My personal average timeline for my single families, let's say, maybe about 3 to 4 months, right? About 3 to 4 months, closer to 4 months because the refi can take quite a bit of time. For my duplex, I'm not even going to give a timeline. Depends on your tenants. Fortunately, my tenant agreed to leave for cash for keys of only $300. So this is my third property, the duplex. Had that tenant not
300 bucks?
For $300, yeah. And their other unit was vacant. Had they not agreed to leave for $300, that turnover would be much longer because there's only so much I can do to try to get a tenant out. Yeah. However, fortunately, I basically got it vacant at that point and turned that around. And once it hit the third property, that's when people started inquiring about joint venturing and partnering with myself. And that's when things really took a turn, and my portfolio completely blew up after that.
No, that makes sense. And then I guess you use joint ventures all the way up to like nearly 20 properties now, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So everything else has been joint ventured since.
Yeah. I think one of the things we haven't actually talked about is what the numbers on a rental in Windsor looks like. Because I think you outlined that like 1 year of rent was over 20 to 25K or something like that, right? So what is the cash flow on a normal like single family house that you do?
In the current market.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, in the current market, it's harder, right? Because your single family homes, if you're buying it in a decent neighborhood, your reappraisal value would probably be anywhere from 260 to even 320. It could range drastically depending on the areas that you're buying. Your rental income for 3 to 4 bedroom, good area, nicely renovated, looking at about $1,800 a month after refinancing, because I'm assuming that most people want to refinance. You're looking at about cash flow, and I'm assuming 10% for CapEx, vacancy, repairs, putting that aside. You're looking at a cash flow of probably about $200 to $350 a month, around that range, especially if you're putting in property management as well, right?
Yeah.
That's about what I've been seeing. Again, it really depends on what your refinance amount comes to, and it really depends on how much you're allocating to property management. Because I think it's unfair. I get property management done pretty cheap because I'm a more favorable client. But when I'm projecting numbers for someone else, an average investor, you got to put 10% in property management, right?
Right.
You got to put 10% in property management, and you got to put 10% in your CapEx, repairs, vacancy. That's 20% of your top line taken off right off the bat.
Yeah, so that takes off about like what, $300 to $350 a month. So you're left with about $1,500.
Then you have your insurance, which your insurance, conservatively, again, I run things conservatively, right? I put things at about $120 to $130. But realistically, you can get it for $70 to $100. And I've gotten it before. But you always want to play your cards right, because I've gotten single families come back at $120. And you don't want to go back and have that conversation with the investor. An extra $20 every single month for the duration of the entire property in perpetuity is because I miscalculated insurance.
Yeah, yeah. So if you start with the $1,800, you take off about $150 roughly for property management. You take off maybe another $150 for your vacancy, CapEx, repairs. You're left with just about $1,500. Take out another $100, maybe $150, because it was a little bit low on the other ones. So you're left with about $1,350. Your mortgage sounds like you're at about like $800, $900.
Yeah, I'm not positive. Maybe around that range.
So $800. Let's just call it $800. And then property tax, I guess, would be the last one, right? So another $200.
Yeah, your property tax would be the last one.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're left with about like $400-ish. I guess it varies on every property for sure. And
yeah, a little less than $400. But fortunately, again, like there's times where I can... is the 1800's conservative. Keep that in mind as well, right? You can get more than 1800. Your property management, if you can keep it less than 10%, that's more spread you're making. And if you're renovating the property, maybe even 10% slush is quite a bit. So it all depends on the personal investor and how they run the numbers. But that's just what I've been seeing based on those very, very conservative numbers. I know that the typical way investors, when they calculate it, they're looking at about $400, maybe to $500 for a single family, if you're being a bit more lenient. But again, that's just me. That's just how I calculate the numbers.
Okay. Yep. And I guess, have you sold anything in your portfolio along the way, or have you just held on to everything?
No, I've sold a couple things in my portfolio. So I think we need to treat to an extent our real estate portfolio similar to a stock portfolio, where you take a look at the returns of the assets that you currently have, and you rebalance it, reshift it, and acquire other properties and get rid of your lower performing assets. There are a couple of ways investors do this. They look at your return on equity, which is that it was just essentially what your return is versus the amount of equity you have in the property. So for most people, that's your 20% down payment plus any equity pay downs you incurred during that time that you're calculating the return on equity equation. Assets with lower return on equity, you might consider selling and rebalancing your portfolio and buying new assets. It also depends on your personal goals. So for me personally, I had a single family home in my portfolio that was generating a couple hundred dollars every single month. But I knew what my new goal was. And my goal was to enjoy some of the money that I made in real estate and buy my primary residence. So then I reshifted my portfolio. I sold my first property and I bought an assignment deal in Toronto. So that's me kind of enjoying the fruits of my labor in real estate. With that property in Toronto, it was about $100,000 or maybe even over $100,000 under market value easily all day long. So I did make a good chunk of equity off of that. And it's just all about rebalancing your portfolio. You can sell properties when you see other opportunities come up along the line. And when your goals change, just keep in mind, if you're holding a single family in your portfolio, that's also taking your borrowing capacity as well.
I think that's an interesting point. So how do you decide between investing in Windsor now and investing in Toronto, which is where you essentially live?
Yeah. So if I had, and I told people this, like if I was to go back in time and I only had, let's say 100,000, I would put all of my money in Windsor, not Toronto. I would like to say I'm investing in Toronto more so for personal use, right? I still have my investor hat when I target that market, but honestly, scalability is difficult in Toronto. You need a lot of money for down payments. You need a lot of money for renovations. A lot of money for materials. You're looking at about over 250K in capital when you're operating in Toronto for a decent deal. Otherwise, you'll be buying turnkey, putting 20% down. And even that, you're getting close to that amount anyways. And also with Toronto, a big hindrance is that your borrowing capacity. In Windsor, all day long, I could hold mortgages for days and days and days. I've been up to 7 mortgages at a point, and I still had room to grow with mortgages. However, in Toronto, I can't even hold one mortgage by myself.
Yeah, that's so true.
The ratios with the properties in Toronto, the rental income is so bad compared to the acquisition price that you're pretty much tapped out. The reason why I'm holding 7+ mortgages in Windsor is because, not anymore. I was holding 7+ mortgages in Windsor was because the ratios made so much sense. So it helped my borrowing capacity. The banks looked at it and say, oh my God, this kid is generating this much income at this much monthly mortgage payment. He can get another mortgage. There's no way that was happening in Toronto. So there are pros and cons to both market. Like if you want something completely passive and you do not care about scaling whatsoever, then Toronto would probably be a decent market. But if scaling early retirement is a goal for you, I could confidently advise you against Toronto. Just being that, man, for you to get early retirement in Toronto, it's not going to be early retirement. You're still looking at 25 years, right?
I think to
get to that financial freedom number.
There's definitely people that have hit financial independence just by investing in Toronto. I think it was a different era and a different time, right? Like if you had started maybe like 5-10 years ago, lower purchase prices, and then the rents go up significantly. So your cash flow increases drastically. That's a different time, different era. We don't know if the same thing will happen in today's market. So I definitely agree with a lot of what you're saying. And a lot of people that I talk to, actually, one of their main like struggles is financing, right? So they've got like one or two properties in the Toronto area. And they're kind of like, look, how do I qualify for another mortgage? And a lot of the conversations I have, surprisingly, with investors is, look, the bank looks at your DSR. If the amount of income that you're adding isn't at least 2 times the amount of debt that you're adding, then yeah, it's going to continuously negatively impact you with every property you're buying. And it goes back to a lot of what you're seeing in the Toronto area. Like your mortgage payment might be like $2,000 and your rents are like $2,500, maybe $3,000. And yeah, then it's going to continuously pull you down. So I think you hit the nugget there.
And I actually just want to challenge you on that point, how Toronto people hit financial independence in Toronto maybe 5 years ago or so. I do agree that people who invest in Toronto 5 years ago made a lot of money, but a lot of them as well don't know how to make money again. What are they going to do? Buy more properties in Toronto and wait for it to appreciate again? What's the point of equity if that equity is not earning you income? Like what? And we know so many homeowners in Toronto who has millions of dollars locked up in debt equity in their property. They should be able to retire by all means. They should be able because they have millions available in equity. But they don't know how to put that equity to work. They don't know how to earn income. So they can't retire, right? And that's a big thing as well, is with small city investing, we're so income focused that we know how to hit that financial independence number, right? Because we're not equity focused as much, although equity is a great little cherry on top, a great little bonus, but we know how to earn income. So if you gave me a Toronto property with $1 million locked in, I'll retire myself in a year. You could retire. Most investors that are savvy can retire themselves in a year, right?
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that a lot of these people, okay, maybe a year is a bit of a stretch. Let's 2 years. But yeah. a lot of these people with $1 million locked in equity, they don't know how to use it. So yeah, you're equity rich, but you're still working your job because you don't know how to earn income.
Yeah, no, that's so true. I think you hit it right on, right? Like a lot of our parents, for example, you're sitting on quite a bit of equity.
Yeah.
But it also goes back to risk tolerance, right? Like, sure, you could private lend that entire thing out. $1 million gets you, I don't know, 12% interest, $120K a year. That should be enough for most people to kind of live on it and replace their employment income. But there is a risk tolerance within it. It comes back to being also, like you said, a savvy investor, right? So you're at 20 properties today. What are you looking for now and what are you up to now, like moving forward?
Yeah, so now I pivoted my strategy more towards, one, the student rental model, and people might be thinking I'm crazy. However, I missed, and we alluded to this a bit earlier in our podcast, so I'm not going to, oh, not this podcast, but I believe our first episode, so check that out, guys, if you haven't already. But basically with the student rental model, people are running away from it now. I'm seeing acquisition prices dropping and I already know what the potential yield of rents are going to be once things normalize, which is high rents. Acquisition prices are low. Beautiful. Like that's cash flow dream once things stabilize, right? I just have to be able to get over the short term to see that long-term potential. And worst case, I can pivot the strategy anyways. However, student rental model one, two is bigger multifamilies is what I'm trying to get towards. More of the 4 to 6 unit range, and then eventually dip my toes in 6 unit plus. But I do want to scale to that, scales of efficiency. I want to get into some bigger units, higher cash flow. You have more control over the valuation of the property. So no more bullshit appraisals, which I've gotten before. Luckily, I was able to figure it out, but that's not a fun, it's not a fun ride to deal with that. But yeah, like it's based on your income. So there's no way of arguing it, right? You have direct control over the valuation of the asset. But that's kind of where I'm leaning more towards now. And yeah, again, like eventually after a while, the financial independence and retire from the corporate job.
All right, man. That's awesome. So now we're at our stage in our interview where we are trying to ask everyone these 3 standard questions. So you ready for that?
I'm going to call you out. We still didn't name this part of the interview, which we need to do.
I just call it the final questions.
Sure. Boring.
all right. So if I was to give you $10 million today, what would you do with it?
If you're to give me $10 million today, one, I'd retire from my job.
Okay.
Straight off the bat. I would probably take $7 million or so. $10 million net. Let's assume net. We're not paying no taxes or anything.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
$7 million of it, I would probably deploy in a mix of private lending, a mix of joint ventureships where I'm the passive partner. Because I do see I would love to be a passive partner. Because we're the active partners right now. And we know that the headaches that come along in real estate, but it's the hustle and grind, right? If I can find someone, if I had $10 million, I want to find someone who's hungry, who wants financial independence, who wants to like work hard for it. And I'll give them money to deploy as well. And then I might end up buying a couple turnkey properties for myself as well. But those mortgage are the 3 things. Sorry?
Mortgage free?
Yeah, probably. Like yeah. It's not a good idea. I know it's like throwing everything at them, but I have $10 million. You don't. So I can do what I can do what I want. Right. So yeah, I mean, I would buy a couple of properties turnkey and then I'll put some money in the stock market and just diversify because I'll have enough capital to diversify among different investment assets and the rest of it, some of it to charity, some of it to family, myself and enjoying.
Yep. No, it makes sense. I think we're going to have to play around with this question. It seems like that's going to be the common answer we get from a lot of investors.
Yeah.
so next, where are we going to see you 5 years from now? What does Austin Yeh 5 years look like? Cuba?
No,
off the radar?
5 years from now, that's a good question. So I've been toying with the thought of going into becoming a high school business teacher. I definitely see that being able to be done in 5 years from now. Reason being is because a lot of the time, I've been doing everything right in life in the sense of accomplishments, right? So I was a very studious student. I would get high grades. I'd get a scholarship. I'd work great internships. But I wasn't satisfied with where I'm at in my career, despite doing all of those things. And I feel like there's probably a lot of other students who are on the same boat. I know there are a lot of other students on the same boat. I know a lot of my friends are on the same boat who are doing something that they're not passionate about, but it just because it earns them a living. And they weren't taught financial literacy. Not a lot of people like yourself, right? You like not, I don't mean to pick on you, but you spent all of your money in university, paycheck to paycheck. Yeah. That's not very financially literate. You could have done so much with that. Fortunately, again, as you aged, you were able to grow your portfolio. So you knew what you were doing. But a lot of people are not like you, right? A lot of people are not going to pick that back up and start making responsible decisions. And I want to kind of instill that in the youth while they're still growing, while they're still learning. Because a lot of the teachers preach one message. But I want to say that, look, I've done the corporate ladder. I've done the school, I've done well in school, I've done the entrepreneurship. Like, these are all the different avenues. These are the pros and cons of each. And this is the importance of financial literacy. If your goal is to retire early, you don't have to work a corporate job forever. But I want to spit the truth to these youths. You know, I sound like a rapper. Spit the truth to these youths.
No, I mean, you know, like your high school days are arguably the days that could shape you for financial freedom, or could completely like destroy you. Because the values and the skills that you build during that grade 9 to 12 is what's going to impact you from when you're like 18 to 22, at least, years old, right? That actually makes a lot of sense. The final question, if you were to have dinner with any person, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
It would definitely be Jay-Z. So I'm a huge hip hop fan, and you guys can probably see on my Instagram. Like, if you go on my stories, I'll drop like a new track every now and then. Well, not me rapping, sorry. I will share a new track every now and then from an artist I like. Jay-Z's been a huge inspiration to me. I've always been a fan of his music, even prior to entrepreneurship. His music is just amazing. Lyrical ability, flow, and all of that. So aside from the artistry point of view and being able to change the rap game, I've learned to appreciate him so much more as a businessman and how he's able to navigate himself in the public eye. We don't see Jay-Z very often, eh? But whenever we do see him and we see him in interviews, he's usually talking about business moves. He's usually talking about chasing your passion. He's giving true advice that falls onto a lot of deaf ears, because it's things that people are just saying, oh, he's Jay-Z, of course he's gonna say that. But as I became more business savvy, some of the things he says is absolutely true about life. He said, to kind of build your moat, like find that one thing that you're very passionate about and kind of build your moat, which means like sharpen your tool set, build that ability, build that skill. And once you have that, you're like untouchable, right? He says things as in to chase your passion. He talks about how to monetize passions. He talks about how to be financially savvy, saving. Like one of his lyrics was, I'm going to butcher it, I'm just going to rephrase it, but something about financial freedom, my only hope, fuck living rich and dying broke. Dude, that's my life. Literally, like in a verse, right? Like in a bar. He said,
I can see you walking around your house rapping to yourself.
Like, yeah, yeah. Like, yo, bro, like, I'm freestyle as soon as I'm done this podcast. But yeah, he like that's literally what it is. Fuck being rich and dying broke. Fuck spending all of your money. Fuck spending, fuck making a $250K and spending every dollar and dying broke, right? And he says, financial freedom, my only hope. Yeah, and that's kind of the mindset that we have as entrepreneurs, is that we're going to try and grind hard to get that financial freedom. We're not spending every dollar that comes in our pocket, right? We're being financially responsible and we're trying to achieve independence and freedom of our life. I can go on and on, but
that makes sense. One last question. It's not really part of our final questions, but at what point did you go from being an investor to an entrepreneur?
Yeah, funny. So I say entrepreneur because everyone calls me an entrepreneur. I don't think I'm an entrepreneur.
Really?
I feel like entrepreneurs are someone who are risk-taking, I guess finding a new problem. I guess to an extent, I'm finding a new problem and solving. I feel like it's just a job because a job I really enjoy because everyone's doing this. It's not like a space where if one person's doing a JV, another person can't do it. To an extent, I guess we are competing with each other if you want to look at it that way, but I don't really look at it that way. It's just kind of like a job, right? People need their money to invest and I'm investing it for them. It's the exact same thing as going to someone who is investing in stocks and you give them money and they're deploying it for you, right? I guess if you want to call that an entrepreneur, sure, but I just call that a very intelligent investor.
No, I'd argue that that is on the side of entrepreneurship, right? Like if you think about someone that owns a hair salon or a barber shop, they're an entrepreneur, right? They're offering the same service as someone else that's a barber as well. So you're doing the same thing. But I guess it sounds like it's a moment that you start investing with and for other people as well that you kind of became that entrepreneur. Sure. So that's definitely a very viable route for a lot of people that start off with just investing with your own money and et cetera. And then you eventually scale to a point where you become an entrepreneur, whether or not you know it and accept it, which I think is what's happening with you, Austin.
Yeah, I guess. Okay. I guess I'm an entrepreneur, but the business plan and foundation and everything was laid out to me. It wasn't like an extremely risky move for me to transition in here. Yeah. I still have my full-time job. I'm still like, I feel like I'm normal. I don't feel like I'm taking on huge amounts of risk doing this.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. You're super humble. All right, so that concludes our third episode of the Rise Network podcast with Austin Ye, our co-host and the founder of the Rise Network. So remember, guys, like, comment, and share this podcast if you enjoyed this episode. And until next time, invest smarter and live better.